Prime Number Day. Next up, number 673, April 29th, 2021.
Hi there, this is Susie from In His Shoes Ministries. Thanks for tuning into the Next Step with Father Vazgen. We are the voice of Armadoxy, a weekly podcast started in 2008 that looks at life through the lens of Armenian Orthodoxy. We reach out to those who are searching for practical and deeper applications of faith, the disenfranchised members of the church community, and the neophyte, those who are discovering truths in ancient Orthodoxy. If you're joining us for the first time, we're so glad you're here. And if you're a regular listener, welcome back. Now, let's get ready to take the next step.
How about an ETB? How about an ETB, estimated time of binge? Yeah, if you were to binge on the next step, as I'm told some people have, that's kind of a mind blower, right? At this point, it would take 4 solid weeks to binge on all of the next steps from day one, from time zero. Yeah. We are at episode number 473. That means to listen to 472 episodes, on the average about an hour each, right? And you have 168 hours in every week, as we know from WD-168, of course. So you do the division, it's exactly 4 weeks, 24/7, to listen to every next step. Now, you may say, is it possible to do? It's possible, but not probable. Would anyone want to do it? Actually, let me tell you something. I had to go look up something. I've been sharing with you for a long time. We've been overhauling our whole ministry, and I have a young lady working on all of the previous next steps and organizing, categorizing. And it's given me an opportunity, because whenever she has questions, she'll let me know I have a question about this. And so I listen in on some of them. Some of the stuff is wild, beyond wild. I mean, each week, how we've been, I don't know. It's like 13 years, you know, every week, solid, consistent. It's been like a blog, an audio blog. It's been ideas. We've had guests. We've had different sections to it. I really miss those bubbles too. Those were in the early years. But I've had a chance to listen to them. And hopefully very soon we'll have the entire collection put categorically, so that if there's a particular episode or a particular topic somebody wants, you can just kind of grab it. Anyway, 4 weeks, okay? So give yourself 4 weeks, 24/7, and you can listen to all of the next steps. How are you doing? I didn't mean to get off on a tangent, but those of you who are with us know that, you know, that happens every now and then. Should I say every now and then, or is it more regular than that? Anyway, welcome. We are in the week after the Armenian Genocide commemoration. It is an unusual week in that many people have sort of like built up to that last week, especially because President Joseph Biden, a Roman Catholic, yeah, I think that matters. I think that matters in this case. He did what no other president had done. He officially recognized the murder of 1.5 million Armenians by the Ottoman Turks as genocide. Now, what that does is it puts it in a different category, right? Genocide. Genocide is not a war. It's not just random killing. It's a program by the government. The government says that we will annihilate, we will wipe out this particular group of people. In fact, it's even more than just a program. It's the rule, it's the law of the government. And as you can see from writings from the early days, from Talat Pasha, from Enver Pasha, actually there's one particular one, I believe it was on May 15th, 1915, that Talat Pasha made the reference that if you do not follow this rule of killing Armenians, Actually, you know what? Let me read it to you because it's beyond belief, okay? Let me pull it up right here. Yeah, when I said beyond belief, it's literally because this is what you got to understand as genocide. And it's very important. When I go out there teaching about genocide, it's very important that people understand this is not just war. I know, just war. Can you believe I actually said that? But it is a program. Now listen to this. This is May 15th, 1915. This is by the Minister of the Interior, Talat Pasha. He writes, "It has been previously communicated that the government, by the order of the assembly, has decided to exterminate entirely all the Armenians living in Turkey." Okay, so the government has decided all the Armenians in Turkey must die. Exterminate. This is the continuation of his order. "Those who oppose this order can no longer function as part of the government." So if you are in the government and you do not kill the Armenians, you can no longer function in that government. "Without regard to women, children, and invalids, however tragic may be the means of transportation, an end must be put to their existence." Okay, there it is. You know, I mean, this is the government guy saying, let's get rid of all Armenians. And that's what constitutes genocide. It's a program by the government to exterminate, to annihilate, to get rid of every person in that particular group. And this is one of the reasons why it was very important for people to have the United States recognize it. And I've gone on record that to me that wasn't as important, say, as for us to be able to say something. And I'm going to share with you some ideas, because now that it has been recognized by the president, not the entire government, last year was it, the year before, we had the United States Congress, which is the House and the Senate, which went ahead and adopted the resolution. But now the president has said, yes, it is. Now, people are reading into this many things, and I want to share with you some ideas. But as a Christian also, there's the other extra added dimension to it, that knowing that a government has wanted a group of people annihilated, what is your response? And I'm saying this because, yes, in history, we can look at the Armenians. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a theologian in the Protestant church, was involved in Germany during the Nazi regime, and he came straight out and he said that I cannot even be a part of this government when there is an annihilation program against the Jews. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer's work is unparalleled when it comes to standing up against the evil, the manifested evil, especially Nazi Germany, not only unparalleled in his work, but his entire life. And he stood up against that and gives us the inspiration. And we won't get into it. I've spent many times here on The Next Step discussing that, and I'll definitely have links for you to explore even more. If this is one of your first Next Steps, please explore what Dietrich Bonhoeffer did during the Nazi times. But it gives us the model by which, as we're looking at our Christian faith, how can we as Christians function inside of a government that doesn't recognize? That's where I want to go. Like, in other words, I said a few minutes ago that President Biden has approved it, recognized it, right? And so has the government. Now, what's the next step? Okay, so he has done that. What does that mean to us? So you've got a president, and albeit he's the most powerful president in the entire world, he has now recognized it. What does that do? Or what does that not do for us? And that's what I want to share with you today. Later on in today's show, I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the philosophical and religious connotations of another writer, not a new writer, but somebody from old times. But I'll get to that in later on in the show. Let's talk about what happened this past weekend. We happened to be in Hollywood when Congressman Adam Schiff, And he is our local representative in Congress, in the United States Congress. But most of the United States, most sometimes even maybe the world, got to know him last year or a couple of years ago when they tried to impeach Donald Trump. They did impeach him, but tried to convict him of the crimes that he had. And it was interesting because Adam Schiff got national notoriety for that front when he was really an advocate for the Armenian cause from very early. And it sort of like was very important for me that people saw what integrity this man had. When you watched him go up against Donald Trump, you saw the integrity in this man. And it's the same integrity that we here in California have enjoyed from him regarding the Armenian community. So we were in Hollywood last Saturday. My son Christopher and I went. I was the opening act, so to speak, basically, to start the... We had done the walk, the March for Justice, and then we got up to the platform, and Congressman Schiff was with us, but I had to do the opening. So I made a point of saying, Congressman, I'm not going to steal your thunder, because obviously that is the big thunderous moment that he, a Democrat member of the Congress, gets to read to us what the President of the United States has offered on this April 24th, something that in the past every other president before him has recognized as Metzieren, the great tragedy, Metzieren. But they have fallen short of saying the word genocide. And that's why I wanted to explain to you what genocide is. Why in the world would they not say genocide? Well, because it's not just that the Turks waged a war, but the Turks wanted us annihilated. And in fact, that annihilation, that wanting us annihilated, continues today, as we saw just a few months ago when they tried to annihilate the Armenians in Artsakh. It wasn't just about Artsakh. It was going in and finishing off what they started in 1915. So much so that the Turkish president even went on record, yes, December 10th, check it out. He went to the capital of Azerbaijan and praised Enver Pasha, which was one of the architects of the genocide. Said that we've got to continue this. So it's very important that you have somebody like the president, you have America, but it doesn't really buy you anything except the satisfaction. Yeah, that's it. That's what it buys you, the satisfaction of having someone big. It's like you're on the play field and people are bullying you around because you're the smallest, the most puny guy on the playground. And then along comes the toughest, biggest, baddest kid on the block or at school. And he comes up and he says, "Hey, punk," to you, looks down at you. And he says, "You're all right, you know, and nobody better mess with you because I know that everybody's been messing with you until now." That's about it. It's not that they're going to stand up and fight for you. It's not like the next guy who picks on you, the big guy's going to come over and grab him by the collar and say, "Hey, lay off of this little guy." It just means that for right now, he's recognized that, yeah, you know, you're all right. I know everybody's been picking on you, but I recognize that. That's about it. That's about what the president's words mean to us. Or should mean. Now, what I'm going to share with you is some personal reflections, because standing there in Hollywood, and like I said, I got up and I said, "Congressman Schiff, I don't want to steal your thunder, because you get that right. As a member of Congress, you get the right to present what the president has said." But from our part, I wanted to thank him. I wanted to thank Congressman Schiff, because no matter what, and before there was a president, whether it was Biden, Obama, or Trump, or whoever it was, Congressman Schiff has been with us all along. So it's looking up at the big, at the tough guy on the playground and saying, "Hey, thank you. Thank you for standing up for me." And that's important for us to do. I don't know what's wrong with us. Sometimes we think that people owe us this favor of recognizing the genocide. And I think this is what I felt throughout this last few weeks, that somehow people felt that, you know, the world owed this to us. And I've shared this with you. It's nothing new. It's like, at the end of the day, what does it buy you? What will it get you? And here's the bigger issue that I felt on Saturday. Does it deflect? Does it take responsibility off of us? So much so that we're looking and we're saying, oh, the president approved it. The president said, okay, and well, what about me? I mean, I can't believe how often we come around and we say that we got it. We have to have people recognize. Is there any question in anybody's mind that this genocide happened? When we give an opportunity for people to debate it, we're giving an opportunity for that questioning. I can't imagine any other people dealing with this. I can't imagine the Jews sitting and saying, let's see if the president will recognize if the Holocaust happened. I'd kill him. They would. If not physically, then in the polls, politically, he'd be finished. Finished. Can you imagine the blacks saying, hey, let's wait and let's see if the president is going to recognize whether slavery happened or not? No, that's a fact of history. And it's the same thing with us. The genocide is a fact of history. And, you know, everybody's out there trying to prove it here and there, you know, like this is what the Minister of the Interior said. This is what the head of the Ottoman Empire said and everything. The mere fact that there are Armenians scattered throughout the world, whereas they weren't there before 1915, is the fact that they were thrown out of a country. They were thrown out. And on the road to death, to whether the Syrian desert or just out there homeless without food or anything, they were able to figure out means by which to survive. And they went away to the farthest places, farthest away that they can get from these atrocities, ending up in places like Argentina, Buenos Aires, you know, the farthest point from Turkey. Why? You don't want to be next to these people that are killing you day and night. So the idea of having to prove it always seemed absurd to me. And I know that there's nobody there. We don't need to prove it to anybody. But every time we open up the dialogue, essentially, that's what we're doing. Secondly, it's giving people a license to play with our history. And that's been something that's always bugged me. Like, why would I allow somebody else? And I understand. I completely understand that there's the political process, and politically you need to have countries aligned with you so that you can prevent what happened last year. But what did it do? What did it do? I mean, you had Israel last year, Israel, which supposedly we bring them to all of the April 24th demonstrations and we remember the Holocaust. You had Israel that basically should be the people that, you know, at least, at the very least, understand the idea of genocide, right? Having gone through the Holocaust. They were selling weapons to the Turks. They were selling weapons to the Turks during the war in Artsakh. I mean, if you need an argument why these political ties are so fickle, there it is. Forget about these political ties. And this is what I really wanted to emphasize. What's happened right now is we've kind of like thrown it on somebody else. The president in this case. And that's what I felt at the demonstration. And again, very subjective. It's just my feelings. But I'm at the demonstration in Hollywood. And I know there were two others in this area. One was at the Turkish consulate. And one was in Beverly Hills. I happened to be at the Hollywood one and started it off. And wanted to start it off with a thank you to Adam Schiff. Because not for... getting this passed or to get the president to say it. But thank you for being with us, you know, despite the difficulties. And I know it was very difficult under the Trump administration, considering the political hostilities that were taking place. It was very difficult for him to stand up and still proclaim that the Armenian genocide had to be recognized. So I appreciated that. But I'm also a realist and understand that it doesn't end with that. And in many ways, he did it because he is the congressman for this area. And there is a large contingency of Armenians, and they vote for him. Okay, that's the politics of it. But still, there are many people who have that contingency and will deny it, and we've seen that too. So here's the bigger issue that I want to share with you today. What does it do for us? Well, in many ways, it becomes a negative experience. And this is what I saw in Hollywood with the young people. They were yelling and protesting, but for what? Talking about a genocide. Very few understood the concept of what genocide was, but also they were calling and asking for the president to recognize, okay, that's fine, but what about us? Where's our responsibility? Where's our responsibility as children of genocide, as children who have been brought up? We're right now four generations out from the genocide. My parents' parents went through the genocide, so I would be second generation. My children would be third, and the children's children would be already into the fourth. There's even fifth generation people who are five generations out from the genocide. If I remember right, in anthropology, I think a generation is 20 years. So yeah, five generations. And we're stretched out from the genocide. So the impact or the reality of genocide or the reality of those people is only preserved to us from the stories that we have, the collective stories and the stories that have somehow been managed to be preserved. In this sense, the Jewish Holocaust has done some remarkable things, especially with the Shoah Foundation here at USC. If you haven't had a chance to experience what they've done, they've actually done stories with Holocaust survivors where they have filmed them from different angles and just incredible, incredible footage that they have. So basically, they can preserve these stories in a form of a hologram. I believe it's a hologram. Basically, it's the individual talking to you, and he or she is a three-dimensional figure who answers your questions. That's fascinating. Like, what was it like on the day that you were asked to leave your home? And they could tell you that. In the Armenian case, fortunately, there were people like J. Michael Hagopian back in the late 60s, throughout the 70s, and he continued his work of documenting genocide survivors. The Millers over at USC, husband and wife, Don and Lorna Miller, they documented. They put out a book called Survivors. So many different places, especially in universities, in educational institutions. I know UCLA. I know that in Michigan. I know throughout. There's so many places that have documented these stories. And these are the stories that we need to plug into. So we get a firsthand account of what's happening. Right now, there's a lady on her deathbed. Her parents were genocide survivors. So we visited just about a week ago. And one of the last things that she wanted out of her life, a long life, and now she's succumbed to an illness and she's in hospice care. But one of the last things that she wanted was a recognition because her parents were defined by this genocide. So it's interesting that just last night we spoke and that the recognition that she would waited for was given through the president. It means something that the president said something. But what I'm questioning is, okay, for her it does, right? I could completely understand Her parents have gone through it. What does it mean now to the fourth or fifth generation removed from the genocide? Is it something to just scapegoat, to throw out and say, well, now it's their responsibility. The president recognized. What about our recognition? Where do we come in? This is what we did back in 2003 when we got together a bunch of young people and we said, what does the genocide mean to you? This is where they came up with the idea of it means if we've been through that tragedy, we have to be awake to other people who are going through it. And sadly, when we sit and we go through this genocide commemoration, there's very infrequent connections to the reality today. For instance, to me, and I shared this in my speech and in my sermon that night. For instance, to me, George Floyd, the hatred that he had on the streets towards him, manifesting in his murder. We are the people who have seen that hatred manifest into genocide. There has to be a connection there. For instance, the children at the border. Right now, there's children at the border. Their parents have dropped them off there because the United States has a law that if they're children, we will take them in. These children who are screaming out for their mothers, for their fathers, we have a connection there. And if we can start understanding that my pain, their pain is my pain, then we start understanding ourselves in a bigger process. And this is the only thing that I've been trying to talk about and share for the last several years, that if we're going to make any sense out of this genocide that took place in 1915, the only way is for it to have some consequences today in the world. Otherwise, it's a matter of history. And this is what I felt in Hollywood. As I was standing there and listening to these kids who just were rattling off different chants about bring justice to Turkey and to Armenians via putting Turkey, punishing Turkey, etc., and etc. What do they understand about these concepts? What does it mean? And how does it relieve them of responsibility? Those are the questions that we need to ask. They're hard questions because it means that we will have to be uncomfortable. It means that we are uncomfortable, not just the president, his uncomfort that he has to sit across from the president of Turkey and explain that, hey, I called you a murderer. But we have to get uncomfortable. And this is really the challenge for all of us. Take a break right now. We play a song of the day. I'm going to pick out something very special. It's a little bit of tranquility. Thank you. String Tranquility is the name of that album. That is oud music by Dick Barsamian and kanun music by Ara Topuzian. I hope you enjoyed it. A little bit of tranquil music amidst all of what's going on in the world, and especially to us as Armenians. Now that we have that recognition from the president, tranquil? Well, at least for right now, right? But what are the implications? Where do we go from here? What do we say? What does it mean to us? And will it stop anything in the future? Those remain to be seen, and we can only be hopeful and optimistic. We will have a link on today's show notes to this beautiful music and the rest of the album as well. Let's get back to our show. Back to talk a little bit more about the aftermath of the genocide. This evening, I'm going to be on a conference call, or I guess it's a Zoom call, with quite a few people. They have State Representative Mari Manoogian, Scout Tufankian, that's kind of cool being with her, Antranik Kizirian, the oud player, musician. We have people from Armenian Assembly, as well as from the ANC, Armenian National Committee of America. It sounds like a really nice lineup, and I'm going to be one of the speakers this evening. And I mention this because we are all trying to put it all together right now. Okay, we are 106 years out from the genocide. And what's more important to me is that how does that influence us as people inside our lives and how we react to others, and especially to others at their time of tragedy. And, you know, we talked a little bit toward the beginning, and all this has to do with our faith. If you have faith in something, you act accordingly. If you don't have faith in anything, you act accordingly as well. And I've been making the case for the last few, at least for the past few months, that we have to get away from the idea that we are living here for an afterlife. And I've gone through quite a bit trying to put this all together, that somehow when we start thinking about, I'm doing this so that I could get into an afterlife, we're all messed up, aren't we? You're doing something for your own personal goals rather than just doing it because it's right. And in a sense, those people who have no belief, no faith in anything beyond this life are a little bit more realistic, are a little bit more sincere about their motives, aren't they? Is sincerity towards motives important to you? I don't know. We saw what happened this week with President Biden. I firmly believe that he, as a Catholic, had a different way of looking at things. His vow that he made during the election, I think it meant something different than the vow that other people had made, just because of his background. And I could be wrong. You know, this is the way I'm reading into it. But follow me on this, okay? Because I've been trying to present here to you, to the listeners, that what Armodoxy is like, can we take the basics of what Jesus taught, the basic command to love, and let's take the hoopla out of it. And so many times our motives get influenced by a life to come. And I also shared with you the idea that it isn't necessary for us to buy into the entire Jewish experience. That, yes, when Jesus said he is the completion of the law and the prophets, something which we pronounce every Sunday through the Holy Divine Liturgy, we say, Gadarum norinatsin tuyes, you are Christ, you are the fulfillment, the law and the prophets. The Old Testament ended, and the New Testament, the new beginning, the new life has started. And Jesus gives us this opportunity to connect with something much greater than just another group of people, but to connect with the universe, to connect with the beginning of all eternity. And I've been pretty adamant about this and talking about it and taking some hits along the way. But lo and behold, because we're going low and I want you to behold this. I found a kindred spirit. I just opened up. There was a book that I read many, many years ago. And the same author had something else. And I said, let me see what it is. So I had read the author. Yeah. Okay. Leo Tolstoy. 1880s. 19th century. 19th century, he writes, the kingdom of God is within you. I remember reading this several years ago. It's about nonviolence, about being the key to our understanding and our ability to live with one another and for us to live as human beings. The kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God is within you. So the other day, I captured a title and I said, wow, that's interesting. Let me read it. And I've got to tell you, beyond interesting, not only a kindred spirit, but has given me the arguments that I was unable to give to you. Basically saying that, you know, Jesus's story is about, or what he calls is the doctrine of Jesus, is about life right now. It's not about something to come. It's about our ability to make this world, the kingdom of heaven right now, enacted. And it has been refreshing to read this. I'm going to highly recommend that you read it. And by the way, there are many versions of it. You don't even need to wait to read it. There are versions on the internet. You could just download a PDF, put it into your Kindle. Highly, highly, highly recommend that you read this. What I want to share with you are some of the takeaways. Leo Tolstoy, of course, prolific writer, somebody, when you look at the volume of stuff that he has written, you just go like, when did he do this? Like, don't you need at least two or three lifetimes to do this? Considering that you're doing this all with pen, right? There's no typewriter. You remember those? Ooh, we said, wow, make life so much faster. How about word processors? How about Word, right? No such thing. This man was writing manuscripts. I mean, you can't, just the volume of material that he has put out. And the quality. Leo Tolstoy, it's a name that you've heard, you've read, these War and Peace, Anna Karenina. We know these stories, but how about his faith? And so I picked up this book called My Religion. And in My Religion, he makes the point. He makes the point that, you know, the doctrine of Jesus was radically different from the doctrine of Moses. Let me say that I added that word radically. It was different. It was different. It gave you different ends. But the way he goes about that is a little bit too philosophical for me. In other words, we in the East, Eastern traditions, don't need that philosophy. Do you know what the basic difference is when I talk about West and East? Think about this, okay? In the West, we have to prove that God exists. And so we will go through arguments. And I don't mean these in very strict ways, but people will argue the point whether there is a God, there isn't a God. And, you know, in Christian tradition, of course, you have the big Western thinkers like Augustine or Aquinas. But you know, probably the most famous one was Saint Anselm. What was it? The greatest conceivable being. His argument that proved that there has to be a God strictly on the grounds of logic alone. Yeah, you don't need anything else besides reason and logic. Let me see, I just pulled it up, okay? So it's a very simple argument. Either God exists or God does not exist. Number two, assume God does not exist, which is the antithesis of this position. If God does not exist, but exists only in an intramental concept, then that being which nothing greater which can be conceived is a being which a greater being can be conceived. This is a logical impossibility. Therefore, God does not exist is incorrect. Therefore, God exists. Now, as you're picking yourself up from the dizziness that caused, yeah, for me especially, it does get you dizzy. And the difference is in the East, it's just either God exists or doesn't exist. We don't need to go through that thing. You're free to not believe it. And that's fine. I mean, the entire Eastern traditions where you have, whether it's Hinduism, Buddhism, you have that idea not of a central God figure as we do in Christianity. And so that kind of like goes into us when we talk about God as mystery, Chorin. It's beyond us to try to prove it. Reason is there. It's good to think of it reasonably. And I do that many times, rationally trying to rationalize. And you've heard my arguments for the resurrection. It's based purely on rationality, isn't it? That these guys who, but, well, I shouldn't say purely on rationality, but rational in the sense that these apostles went and witnessed to something that they didn't need to, and they were willing to go to death. And that in itself was proof enough. The same way that we look at Armenians. Why did the genocide happen? We try to prove it, right? With many ways, the ultimate proof is just a very logical, reasonable answer. Before 1915, there were no communities outside of Armenia, very sparse, small little communities. Today, there's huge, thriving communities of Armenians outside of Armenia, on the other side of the globe, in weirdest places that you could assume. Why? Because we were kicked out of the homeland. Okay, so basically the logic continues, and you figure this out. What Tolstoy gives us is an opportunity to really experience the Christian message, Christ's message. And it begins with that idea that what Jesus said when he said, resist not evil, it wasn't something that was impractical. And I want to just, I'm not going to go into it. I want to spend some quality time with you sharing the Tolstoy story. And that's why I'm asking you now to pick it up and read it so that when we talk about it in the next few weeks, you'll have some background on it. But I do want to leave you with this. It's interesting because he made this point, and I love this analogy. He says a lot of times when we look at the statements given by Jesus, we find them to be impossible to achieve. And so we say that, well, what Jesus said is good, but it really is impractical. We can't do it. For instance, you have heard that it was said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you. Do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. He goes on to say, you have heard that it was said, love your neighbors and hate your enemies. I tell you, love your enemies. Pray for those. So he goes into some of the definitions, what they mean. He tells you his personal experiences. But here's the story that he says. I love this analogy. He says that, and I'm going to go ahead and just read it. So it's in the first person. He says, suppose that I am shut into a dark room. And in searching for the door, I continually bruise myself against the walls. Someone brings me a light and I see the door. Okay, so imagine this. Okay, you're in a dark room. You're looking for the door and you're bruising yourself because you can't find it. You're knocking against the furniture, against the walls, and it's not pleasant. Then someone brings a light and you see where the door is. I ought no longer to bruise myself when I see the door. Much less ought I to affirm that, although it is best to go through the door, it is difficult to do so, and that, consequently, I prefer to bruise myself against the walls. And think about it in what we say. We look at Jesus' passages and we say, oh, they are too difficult to do. Jesus must meant these metaphorically. He could not have meant this for all of us. But he has given us that light. He's given you that ability to see the door. So even when the door is closed, even when you're in that dark room, you know where the door is. So he's given you this opportunity for the goodness. Why do we keep saying that, oh, it's difficult, we can't do it, when we know that the door is there, that the opportunity is there? Fascinating. I am just in love with this writer even more. I told you a few years ago when we were doing some work, it was toward the beginning of the In His Shoes ministry. And if you remember, if you go back to 2015 during the Armenian Genocide 100th anniversary, artist Greg Baylarian and I did this incredible project called The 100-Year Journey. And one of the things that we really worked on was to create artwork, to create a storyline that we could talk without invoking negative or hateful words. In other words, can you talk about genocide, something as horrific as genocide, using words and metaphors that will not incite more hatred? And I guess this is where I was coming from Saturday, when I was looking and seeing people just yelling and screaming about, you know, the Turks, we have to bring down the Turks. It's always this negative imagery. And what is the reasoning for that? Well, when you look at the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, you see this people that are constantly being abused. And God, why aren't you calling out for this? Obviously, it's not a different God in the Old Testament, but the people's understanding is quite different, quite different. You know, when Jesus is up on the cross saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? What is he doing? He is quoting from Scripture. He is quoting from the Psalms, right? I believe it's Psalm 22. He's quoting the Psalms. But what do the people think? They think that he's calling out for Elijah. In other words, there's that disconnect that something great is happening in front of you, and there is an opportunity for eternity, and we're disconnected by looking at these mundane things. Oh, he's calling out for Elijah. And those people who said it were the people, the learned ones, the ones of the law. In other words, they were doing the things according to the book and so on. But they didn't get it. They didn't get what was in front of them, that there was the Son of God up on cross. And when I talk about armadoxy, it's about sifting out all that mundane. Let's look at what the centerpiece is of our tradition, of our faith. Let's look at that. Jesus up on the cross. The other night at Bible study, somebody said that, you know, we have to give credit to, there's some churches that have kept the Armenian spirit going and the Armenian feeling, and they have done a wonderful job in preserving the Armenian language and culture. And, you know, my answer to that was, yeah, that's right. They've done a wonderful job. That's been their mission. It's not the kingdom of God, it's not promoting Jesus, but preserving the Armenian language and the people. Which, if you want to buy into it, is your business, right? But it's not the job of the church. It's not for which we got ordained. If you did your job as a church in following the gospel message, that it is for this reason that I came, Jesus said, to mend the brokenhearted, to preach the good news. If you do that job, everything else will fall into place. Your nation, your ethnicity, your background, your history will be shining in the world. But don't do it for that reason. In other words, that's not the end in itself. And I guess that brings us full circle. That's what I felt in Hollywood, okay? That people were yelling that, yes, President Biden has accepted the genocide, as if that's the end in itself. And it's not. It's not. Just a week before, George Floyd, his murder trial had taken place. Derek Chauvin was convicted of murder. And the attorney general, the one who prosecuted, said today's verdict is not justice. Justice implies restoration. But it is accountability, which is a good start. And I think that's what we have to put in perspective. This is one step towards accountability. Excuse me, one step towards justice as accountability. It's a start. All right, let's leave it at that. That'll give you a lot to think about. But do check out all the show notes and do check out that particular show note, Leo Tolstoy, My Religion. And I'm finishing it up. I should have it finished by next week. We'll talk a little bit more about it because it is fascinating, and it's most fascinating that up until now I thought I was just swimming alone in this vast ocean of all kinds of things coming at you. And I felt like a kindred spirit. I felt like, wow. And I think more fascinating is that I arrived at it in the same manner that he arrived at it. After you see everything in life, you say that, wow, there has to be something more than just me self-serving and saying, I've got to get into a heaven. No, it's been more than that, actually, for me, the last 30, 40 years. Anyway, we will take a break right now because the piano player is here, because Susie's here to make her announcement. I'll be back in a couple moments, okay?
Before getting back to the next step with Father Vazquez, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that this ministry is supported through the heartfelt donations of listeners like you. Thanks for keeping us in your prayers and partnering with this expanding and dynamic outreach. The next step is entering homes and communities with a solid message proclaiming God's message of love, forgiveness, and compassion. We look forward to your comments and words of encouragement. Please consider partnering in this dynamic ministry by making a contribution. By pressing on the donate button on our website, you can set up automatic donations, either weekly, monthly, or annually. Your donation goes a long way in furthering this ministry. Even more, tell your friends and family by sharing the Next Step link or website with them. We're on iTunes and Blueberry, as well as Facebook and Twitter. We are excited about this ministry and invite you to share in our enthusiasm. This is Susie wishing you all of God's blessings in your life. We now return to the Next Step with Father Vazquez.
Thank you, Susie. Thank you, everybody, for your love, your notes. Oh, man, your notes are fantastic. I appreciate everybody who writes in, who shares their love, and for all of your support, whether it's financial or whether it's, more importantly, with your prayers. Keeping us in mind as you do pray, that this is a ministry that is important. I know sometimes we get off and, you know, it's just an all-around opportunity for us to come together weekly, share some ideas. And in that respect, I would love to hear from you. Drop me a line at feedback@epostle, that's apostle with an E. Namely, we're apostolic evangelism for an electronic world. And we've been talking about this in our Bible study about the apostolic beginnings and everything. I think things are coming around. We are getting ready to put this all down together as a form of armadoxy, making it something very tangible. And I'm very thankful that you're coming along for the ride, that you're giving me this opportunity to do this. This evening, we will be online for that program, Do Not Erase Us. Over the weekend, we have all kinds of things going on. We were out there in Rancho Mirage last Saturday night, and something really beautiful happened. We had a gentleman come up to me, and he said he was adopted at age 10 by a Scandinavian family. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, Scandinavian. Aren't they like blonde-haired, blue-eyed? And all of a sudden, there's this Armenian cat in there, right? Okay, so anyway, he shared with me his story. At age 70, he has found out that his roots are Armenian. And so he had attended the genocide commemoration in Rancho Mirage because he had Googled and he had found out that I was going to be there. And so he shows up and we had a chance to meet each other, talk a little bit. And it just tells me how powerful this means of communication, this network of computers, cell phones, earbuds, whatever it is, it's a powerful way of bringing us all together. I think we can even safely say where two or three are connected in my name, there I will be as well. I want to believe that. And I hope you, I know you do too. We're connected. virtually, invisibly, nah, there are some tangible ways of connections, and I think you all know that as well. Listen, I want to thank you for giving us this opportunity, and I look forward to being with you during the weekend on the many socials and the different ways that we connect, and also again next week. So on behalf of our producer Susie and myself, this is Father Voskin inviting you to join us again next week as we take the next step.
And now here's the fine print.
The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskullness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of vpostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
I forgot to ask you if you're seeing the same sky as we are.